Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
What's going on in the oceans? Gray whales have been washing up along the coasts of Washington State and Alaska in increasing numbers in recent years. Migrating gray whales are also arriving in Alaska in greater numbers and showing up in places where they were not so populous in the past. What's known about why whales are dying and changing their summer migration routes? Today on Talk of Alaska, we'll hear about what is affecting ocean health and why marine mammals, seabirds, and fisheries are under stress.
Alaska Public Media is all about community. Wear your community on your sleeve with the purchase of branded clothes and collectibles from our online store. Visit alaskapublic.org/shop.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Climate warming, pollution, and other challenges are changing marine conditions in Alaska. What's happening with food availability and distribution in the Earth's oceans, especially in the Arctic? Today, we'll hear from experts in ocean science about the primary problems, why they're happening, and what can be done to help oceans recover. If whales are not finding enough food in some areas of the ocean, what does that mean for food availability for other sea creatures and for the human populations that also depend on marine resources? Rick Steiner has spent decades researching these issues and advocating for change to help the marine environment. Rick is a former professor of marine conservation for the University of Alaska Anchorage and is a consultant on international marine issues. Thanks for being here today.
Glad to be here. Thanks, Lori.
Good to have you in the studio. Delbert Pingawi is on the line from the community of Savunga on St. Lawrence Island. Delbert is the former president of the native village of Savunga, and he, like many remote coastal residents, relies on the ocean to feed his family and community. Delbert, thanks so much for being with us today.
I thank you very much, too, for this very important topic.
Also with us is Matt Van Dale. Matt, we're happy he could join us from Kodiak. Matt is the Natural Resources Director for the Shunek Tribe of Kodiak and has been monitoring gray whale activity and strandings near Kodiak. Welcome, all of you. Thanks for all of you being on with us today. Matt, really glad you could join us.
Yes, Chamai, hello, and Koyana for the invite.
Yes, thanks for being here. So, Rick, start us off here. Let's start, because it's been so dramatic recently, with the gray whales. What is known about how large the die-off numbers are, and what's happening? Why is this happening?
It's part of a larger picture. Alaska's oceans are certainly the crown jewel of America's ocean ecosystems, and they're in serious trouble. We've known this for decades. We know the causes and the consequences, and we pretty much know how to correct it. But the current management regime is not able to do that. So we need to shift that. For gray whales, they're becoming the next sort of canary in the mine shaft in the Arctic climate change issue, as polar bears were 20 years ago. Gray whales have fluctuated depending on the abundance and quality of their seabed food resource, which are these little bugs that live within the seabed sediment, amphipods. And when there's an abundant amphipod resource in the Chukchi and Northern Bering Sea ecosystem on the seabed, gray whales boom. When there's not, they collapse. The benthic amphipod population has been declining over the last 50 years, and the quality of the kind of amphipods that the gray whales need has also been changing and declining. And so they're in a population depression right now. The last 2 years, there's been 330 or so dead gray whales wash ashore in Mexico, the U.S., Canada, and Alaska. And that translates to something like probably 3,000 dead individual gray whales, about tenfold die offshore than you actually see stranded ashore. So there's a really serious problem. Many of the ones stranding are emaciated. They show, you know, food stress. Some are showing ship strikes and propeller strikes and things like that and entanglement. But largely, this is a problem with climate change, reduced sea ice, change in the Arctic ecosystem such that the seabed ecosystem is not getting the organic matter and the prey resource for gray whales is declining. So it's a very serious problem that needs to be addressed.
You mentioned sort of a boom bust depending on food availability for the whales, but has it been a steady uptick in mortality or does it sort of differ from year to year?
It differs from year to year. Okay. It's a good point. I mean, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, declared what they call an unusual mortality event for gray whales from 2019 till 2023, in which the total population estimate declined about 6,000 from a 25,000 total population. So that's a pretty significant drop. 6,000 whales.
Huge. Out of 25,000?
That's right. Yeah. And they're a very low reproductive species. You know, they used to have 1,000 to maybe 1,500 calves in the Mexico Baja calving lagoons every winter. Last year, they had 85, the lowest on record. We don't know the number for this year yet, but it's going to be similarly low. So they're not reproducing well. If they're starving in the Arctic, in the Chukchi, they don't have the food resources to have a calf. And so the calving rate has been very low. So it varies year to year. NOAA declared an end to the unusual mortality event in 2023, but they should have redeclared it last year because the last 2025 and 2026 have been significant mortality events. We're calling it a catastrophic mortality event.
And we'll talk more about that as we get into the program, but I want to turn to you now, Matt. On Kodiak Island, you've observed a big uptick in gray whales near Kodiak. Tell us about that change and what's known about why they've been showing up in greater numbers.
Yeah, we're not quite sure why they're showing up in greater numbers yet. But you are correct. Last year, we saw a dramatic uptick in the number of whales that stayed around Kodiak for the entire summer season, which is somewhat rare. Usually we're just kind of a stopover point or a rest stop at a gas station, basically, for whales as they journey farther north. In the past, we have had a number of individuals hang around the archipelago for the entire season, probably about 50 to 75. But last year in one specific area, for those of you that are familiar with Kodiak, it's called Passagshack Narrow Cape area. And we had probably about 250 to 300 stay in that small area at the south end of the Kodiak Road system for the entire season. And we're not sure why. It's likely that either they're very intelligent individual species. They probably learned that there are food resources here and they had enough food resources to stick around for the entire season. It's probably not because their increase of food resources, but they just decided they wanted to hang out here instead of going farther north. We've been seeing something similar this year, but because of fuel prices, we haven't been able to do boat-based surveys because fuel prices have just gone through the roof. And we're hopeful that we're going to be able to continue our monthly surveys with the Coast Guard, but we've been running into issues with those this year because of airframe availability and also maintenance issues and weather as we're having today.
There's also, of course, sadly, been dead whales washing up in your region. Have you been able to perform necropsies on some of these whales and found potential causes of the deaths?
We haven't been able to do any full necropsies yet this year, but in our visual assessments and when we are able to collect some samples, one whale definitely appears to have been killed by orcas. One is unknown if it was ultimately killed by orcas, but they didn't actually eat much of any of this whale. And the other one is unknown, but a couple of them definitely appear to be emaciated this year. Whereas last year, when we were able to do more thorough assessments, it was about 50-50 between very emaciated whales and other whales that were emaciated and were likely orca mortalities. So that leads you to believe that these whales are in poor body condition, and so they might not have enough energy to be able to escape and evade orcas.
And before we get to Delbert, thank you for your patience, Delbert. Matt, you were supposed to be on a Coast Guard flight this morning to look for whales, but it got pushed to this afternoon. That's lucky for us. What will you be looking for when you can fly out later today?
We're going to be attempting to fly almost the entire coastline of the eastern Kodiak Archipelago in looking for dead stranded gray whales, because we're able to massively increase our coverage area with these Coast Guard flights, but also looking for live whales and trying to do an aerial assessment if we are seeing increased numbers of live whales this late into the season.
All right, thank you for getting us started here. Delbert, I want to turn to you now on St. Lawrence Island. You said in an earlier interview you were born in 1959, just a little younger than me. And you're an expert because of your lived experience being in this place. Talk about life on St. Lawrence when you were growing up as compared to today, 67 years later, as it relates to health and abundance of subsistence food on and around the island.
Okay, I thank you very much for this opportunity. Very important discussions we're having. I've been advocating for climate change crisis for many years, but I was born, I like to introduce myself in this way so the audience would get a better perspective of who I am and my life that I lived here on the island. As you said, I was born in 1959. I grew up with 9 solid months of winter. Hard winters. We didn't have no motorized vehicles. Stove oil heaters were just being introduced. Over 90% of our food security was from the Bering Sea itself. And during the summer from the greens and from the island, the land itself. Times were different then. I've seen great changes in my time. When I reflect back on my life, to me, that was a beautiful life. I was happy. I was a happy child. As long as we had food, everything was good. And I was a grandfather's grandparents' child, Alfred and Romola Tumlu, on my mother's side, and on my father's side, Laura Pangawi and Donald Pangawi. And our eldest leader, Amos Pinaya, whom I went to school with, to never forget my identity of our spiritual way of being. But in my time, I in my speakings in London, Iceland, and Washington, D.C., in my lifetime, that I've been witnessing in real time our age-old way of life literally melting away. And I know Rick will reflect on this when he was out here on the island working with the fisheries. The changes, the spectacle I saw growing up at the cliffs, the black clouds of birds swarming. You could literally half a mile from our village, you can literally hear them chirping, the chrysid auklets, the loudest little bird, chunky bird. And then in 1983, my grandfather told me, he told me about our identity, our spiritual way of being. These laws my people live by I was told that they were not man-made laws. It was our creator's laws of how we were supposed to take care of and protect our earth. We called her our Mother Earth. But the great changes that my grandfather, some say it's a prediction, but I say he told me what was coming, that 1983, in my time, we are going to witness great changes. There's going to be lots of ice. The Gulusik ice, we call it. Siku is ice. Gulusik is the mother ice, the polar ice, as the scientists call it, the multi-year ice that's been around since the last ice age, which came and set the winter in October. Before November, the Bering Sea would be completely locked up over 100 miles south of our island. And he told me that there's going to be great loss of ice, which will have worldwide consequences of catastrophic disasters, weather changing, that the polar ice do not reach us anymore, the Gulusik. In our language, the Gulusik is the mother ice, we call it. Big behemoth, humongous icebergs, beautiful blue color. They don't reach us anymore. The only ice we get now is Sikulik. The Sikulik is the young ice that's formed as a slush from the bottom and it floats up. In 2016, I have a gnome nugget. The Bering Sea heat wave triggered nosedive in the Yukon River. The intense heat, which began in 2016. We work closely with the NOAA scientist, Rick Thoman. They've been studying the Bering Sea for over 30 years. And we've been working with them all those years very closely. There was the intense heat wave, which the catastrophic die-off of the seabirds, the merbirds, the all the seabirds, and Alexis Will, who is the scientist, been studying our cliff birds, the crested auklet. In 2018, it had a catastrophic die-off as well, and all the seabirds that were the catastrophic die-off washing up on our beaches, just littering our beaches. It's just heart-wrenching.
Yes.
In my people's way, all the species we respect that we depend on. And the spectacle I saw as I was growing up, I'll try to close it up with this. Ducks, the seabirds, the ducks, the cormorants, all the seabirds, just millions and millions of them nonstop going north in the fall time, huge mega flocks. I thought as a young man, that all this food source has been with us for thousands of years and it will always be with us. I was so thankful for that. But the spectacle we see as I was growing up is no longer. Mm. So everything is crashing. And when the heat wave struck, the scientist came out here immediately. Alexis Will, who works with the World Wildlife Fund, her boss came out and collected the crested auklets. And they reported they couldn't find anything what was killing them, but they were emaciated. They were literally starving to death. So I said, 9 months of solid winter, the Bering Sea, over 200,000 square miles, which created all these phytoplanktons, these copepods, which created immense food, more than enough, from the tiniest little creature to the biggest whale, the bowhead whale. So I told the scientists that the Bering Sea is not producing enough food anymore. So that is a serious problem. And the United Nations report that oceans are in serious trouble. So again, like Rick said, the urgency to protect our oceans, we are really at a critical point in time.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Dalbert, for giving us such a clear picture of your observations as life on St. Lawrence Island has changed so dramatically in what we know is a fairly short amount of time, just 67 years of Delbert's life. If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about the whale die-offs that have been occurring up and down the Alaska and Washington state coasts, and the health of the oceans, and how we can look at what's happening, get clarity on that, and move towards solutions for the future. In the studio with me is Rick Steiner. Rick is a former UAA professor of marine conservation and an international consultant on ocean issues. Delbert Pungawi is the former president of the native village of Savoonga and is a resident of that community on St. Lawrence Island. He joins us on the line from St. Lawrence. And Matt Van Dale is the natural resources director for the Shunek tribe of Kodiak and is on the line with us from Kodiak. Rick, we do have an email question, but I want to, Delbert was giving us such a clear, articulate look at what the changes he's seen throughout his life on St. Lawrence. And you've been in Alaska and in coastal communities for more than 50 years. First as a commercial, you were commercial fishing for crab and salmon, halibut, black cod. I'm getting hungry now. You were a fisheries observer in the 70s on Japanese pollock ship in the Bering Sea. And when you began work with the university, you were stationed in Kotzebue, traveling to coastal villages, talking to local residents about marine science. Give us a snapshot of what you saw in that era in the villages for abundance of marine catch in that time.
Yeah, the change between, say, 1970s and 1980 and today is remarkable. And I think Delbert kind of captured some of that in his discussion there. The sea ice was extensive. We've been losing sea ice at about 1% a year in the last 40 or 50 years, and the thickness is thinned by about two-thirds. I wanted to pick up real quickly on what Delbert was talking about, the seabird cliffs there east of Savoonga. When I was working on the island out there, we used to go out and sit on those cliffs, and it was an absolute majestic manifestation of the Bering Sea productivity. Mm. Thousands of auklets would swirl around your head and dive down into the rocks and nest and then go offshore and feed and then come back. And as Delbert was relating, that has declined dramatically. The seabird die-off that he was referencing in 2016, 17, and 18, we lost about 4 million murres in Alaska, 4 million in a couple of years due to the marine heat wave that occurred, and they couldn't dive deep enough to get access their food resource. That's today counted as the largest warm-blooded organism die-off in world history. Pretty remarkable. And that is unfortunately what our future looks like, more massive die-offs. We have seabird die-offs every year, but as well, marine mammal populations have plummeted throughout the Alaska offshore ecosystem. Fur seals are down 70%, Steller sea lions down 70 to 80%, Aleutian sea otters down 95%, the ice seals in the Arctic Ocean, the four species, are down, struggling dramatically, walrus are down. Many whale species are still endangered and struggling. So the ecosystem is not healthy, and the current management regime isn't able to adapt to that.
You said earlier in the program, you alluded a bit to this, but in an earlier interview, you said that the marine ecosystems are in serious trouble, if not in catastrophic collapse. I was somewhat stunned by that statement. What leads you to such a troubling finding of what's happening currently in the oceans?
Well, when you look at just the Alaska situation with the dramatic decline, let's just take one of the upper trophic levels, the upper food chain levels, marine mammals. They're almost ubiquitously in collapse. There's some that are not. Bowhead whales seem to be doing okay for a time. I don't think that's going to continue long into the future, honestly. The entire Arctic Ocean ecosystem has shifted dramatically. The pelagic, the water column productivity is now decoupled from the seabed productivity, which is what's causing gray whale problems, their food resource problems. And there's another phenomenon that's just been identified called benthic denitrification, where the biomass that's created by phytoplankton in the Arctic Ocean sinks to the seabed, anaerobic bacteria suck the oxygen and the nitrate out of the water, and that causes problems. Nitrate is an absolutely essential nutrient for all phytoplankton. So there's some scientists in Europe that have been studying the Arctic Ocean off of Greenland, and they have concluded that this crossed a irreversible tipping point in 2009, that it's irreversible, denitrified Arctic Ocean waters. Nobody has really modeled that going forward, what that's going to mean to the entire Arctic Ocean ecosystem. That could be happening further south in the Bering Sea too, I don't know. But ocean health, if you look at the entire system put together, from bottom up the seabed, the pelagic system, phytoplankton, all the way to the top predators, it's sort of a disentanglement of the system. The way I phrase it is a catastrophic collapse in the ecosystem that we had 50 years ago. 50 years ago, by the way, is when the 200-mile limit was passed in the United States, the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation Management Act, 50 years ago this year. And then it went into effect where we claimed jurisdiction out to 200 miles. The management systems that were set up during that time worked for prioritizing fish catch, but not for protecting marine mammal and seabird declines. And that's what we need to fix.
Mm. Well, thank you for that context that is so important in this moment. When I first came to Alaska 27 years ago and started interviewing climate scientists, I remember the early days of those interviews when scientists would say, well, we expect the Arctic will see ice-free summers in about 100 years. Mm-hmm. Then a few years later, it was 50 years. Now, arguably, you know, we're seeing a lot of vessel traffic through there. That is a very short timeline to go from speculating out a century to, well, it's happening. How, when you look at that as a scientist, what does that trigger for you, the amount of really recognizable change that's happened in less than 30 years?
That's a fantastic point, and it brings to front the perspective that our models are under-predicting the change in the Arctic Ocean, and I believe in the Bering Sea and Gulf of Alaska as well. The last two winters of sea ice have been spectacularly low in the Arctic, way well below what the models had predicted. And so what that tells us is we need to be more cautious in our management responses here. We need to, you know, predict what we can based on the information that's available, but also understand that these predictions are just that, and they could be overestimates or underestimates. We don't really know. Nobody can clearly predict where all this is going, but I think the trajectory is very, very clear that the Arctic, Bering Sea, and even Gulf of Alaska are in serious trouble.
All right, we need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about whale die-offs and what it means for the health of the ocean and other marine dwellers that live there, as well as coastal populations, as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Alaska Public Media is all about community. Wear your community on your sleeve with the purchase of branded clothes and collectibles from our online store. Visit alaskapublic.org/shop.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing whale die-offs and ocean health. Rick Steiner is in the studio with me today. Rick is a former UAA professor of marine conservation and an international consultant on ocean issues. Delbert Pangawi is the former president of the native village of Savunga on St. Lawrence Island and joins us from his home community there. And Matt Van Dale is the natural resources director for the Shunack tribe of Kodiak and is on the line from that island community. So we have two island dwellers with us today. I did want to get to an email question from Michelle. Michelle writes, I've learned krill is being harvested in the South Pacific for supplements and maybe dog food. How widespread is this fishing of the bottom of the food chain in the oceans? What effect does it have? Who wants to take a shot at that? Rick, do you want to? Matt, you could weigh in then.
Very quickly, yeah, there's a huge krill fishery that's developed in the Southern Ocean, which circles the Antarctic, probably one of the most productive oceans on Earth, in addition to Alaska's oceans the way we used to be up here. But the krill are a critical prey resource for whales, penguins, seals, and a number of fish species down there. And it's an enormous resource, but that's what drives the Southern Ocean ecosystem. All the energy transfer up to the higher trophic levels comes through krill. And so now that the fishing fleets, the foreign fishing fleets, have started targeting krill there, there's a real concern about competition with these higher trophic levels, penguins and seals and whales and things like that, and seabirds, other seabirds. So there's an effort to try to dial that down. Fortunately, we don't have any of that low ecosystem, lower on the food chain harvesting going on in Alaska waters, really. But it's something to be concerned about in the Southern Ocean.
Well, in the realm of food availability, we know that warming is driving species north, including in the oceans. How is that changing competition for food and the availability of it?
Well, the warming is a big factor. Oceans are have been very stable temperature-wise over the years, and a 1 degree change in ocean temperatures can be huge for marine wildlife. Scientists have looked for patterns in ocean atmosphere interactions, and they've identified the El Nino Southern Oscillation causing this El Nino event that we're looking at this winter, the North Pacific Gyre Oscillation further north, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation further north in the Bering Sea and Gulf, and then the Arctic Oscillation. Basically, there's a lot of, most of these are natural cycles.
Sure.
But human-induced climate change and these marine heat waves from it are amplifying the impact. So you have globally, the ocean average temperature, subpolar temperatures, were an absolute historic record during the human lifetimes. Last month, they reached about 70 degrees average temperature, 70 degrees Fahrenheit. So oceans are absorbing about 90% of the additional heat that we've generated into the atmosphere and about 30% of the additional CO2, which is causing acidification, which is another problem for fish and shellfish.
Especially in the oceans. Matt, your thoughts here, and also thinking about, as you were talking about these oscillations, the currents that flow through the oceans and seas around the Earth, and how temperature affects the speed at which they do or do not move. Matt, I see you nodding your head. Please weigh in here.
Yes, yeah. Very good questions and lots of possible responses to this, but I definitely want to echo what Delbert and Rick were saying, in particular about the increase in ocean temperatures, this potential very large El Nino event that we have coming our way that we're already starting to go into. And when we had something similar in Kodiak was when the blob, the marine heat wave happened in the Gulf of Alaska. And that was coincident down here with the mer die-off that Delbert was talking about, and also shearwater die-off, an extreme shearwater, which is another marine bird die-off. And also coinciding with a large whale unusual mortality event that seemed to really particularly hit humpback and fin whales hard from the Pacific coast of Canada all the way into the Gulf of Alaska, including Kodiak. And so that's something that's very much on our sonar going forward. Even though El Nino is likely going to hit this year, well, it's already hitting, but the main effects are probably going to be over this winter. We do have a mass of very warm ocean water coming our way rapidly. And so theoretically, potentially next summer is when we're going to see the real impacts, especially with marine birds and whales, large whale species. And that's particularly concerning with the marine birds if we're going to have another large die-off event, because the warming waters are pushing the prey farther away than the birds are able to fly, especially during critical nesting season, but also pushing their prey resources deeper, so they're not going to be able to physically dive deep enough to get those food resources. And these birds are a very important subsistence species for us in the Kodiak Archipelago and around the Gulf of Alaska as well. So that's something that we're monitoring very closely. And you're asking about the currents and how the currents are changing. If we're able to do that Coast Guard whale survey this afternoon, this evening, two of the main areas are the two large islands at the south end of the Kodiak Archipelago. And these are a confluence of currents within the Gulf. And so they effectively serve as collector beaches. So when a whale dies somewhere else in the Gulf, they tend to end up, if they wash ashore, washing ashore on these islands. But as Rick was talking about earlier in the program, all of these whales that we have stranding on our beaches is only a tiny little tip of the iceberg of what is actually happening out there, because we only see a small percentage of whale mortalities actually showing up on shore. And then we'll be able to, see them and potentially respond and better understand what's going on. And gray whales are definitely a very critical species to be researching and trying to understand, trying to, when we're able to respond to a carcass, trying to understand what happened to that individual whale and what it can teach us about its kin in the overall population, because they're absolutely sentinels of the sea, both because of how adaptable they are, but also because of the very long migration. So it's definitely a species that we need to be paying closer attention to. But with it not being listed as an endangered species, listed species, the funding and the time and the resources are just not necessarily present that would be for another species, because they're what we call an umbrella species. Because when gray whales are doing poorly, it's a very good indication that there's something seriously amiss with the overall ecosystem and
That's a great
climate.
point.
Yes, excellent. Thank you for that context. Delbert, when you think about some of the important foods for residents of St. Lawrence Island, the availability of seals and walrus, how has that changed near the island? And what are you observing about the health of the marine animals when you do harvest them?
The all the species, I fear not for myself, but for our future generations. Our fruit, our I've argued this in our in my travels in to meetings of our marine species, seabirds, whales, seals, that our food security is at its imminent threat. And the cost of outside goods, groceries are just way too high. So over 90% of our food security to this day comes from the Bering Sea itself. So the seal harvesting is not as abundant as it used to be. It has severely declined. We still get the bowhead whales. They seem like they're still doing good. The walrus is still doing good. It looks healthy. But the one thing I like to mention is that not just the heat wave, but all the pollution, my grandfather told me, is accumulating in the Arctic through air and ocean currents. So, 2023, I went to Canada for the fourth Intergovernmental Plastic Treaty negotiations. I've told the scientists in London to research the Arctic. What happens in the Arctic has a domino effect worldwide to the other oceans. And we are now witnessing the domino effect with the other oceans. The United Nations reported that the oceans are in urgent need to be protected. They are on the verge of collapsing. the conveyor belts. The one thing I wanted to mention, the health of the species that we depend on, are they're finding microplastics in the waters, in the seals. And that means they're saying it means that it's in everything. So we're eating that, and I eat the subsistence food itself, but knowingly I'm eating microplastics. I don't have a choice,
Oh.
and that is heart-wrenching.
Yeah, it certainly is. I agree that that is one of the issues that we haven't talked in depth about is pollutions, but microplastics, there's growing awareness of how severe that problem is and how difficult it is to deal with. We do need to take another quick break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the health of the oceans and what can be done to help them in the future as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing whale die-offs along the coast and the health of the oceans and the future. As we get to the last quarter of our program here, we're going to talk about what can be done and some of the solutions. We've identified some very serious issues. And our guests today are Rick Steiner, former UAA professor of marine conservation and international consultant on ocean issues, Delbert Pangawi, who is the former president of the native village of Savoonga and lives there on that in that community on St. Lawrence Island and joins us from there, and Matt Van Dale is the natural resources director for the Shunack tribe of Kodiak and joins us on the line from Kodiak. Doug in Anchorage writes, can you touch on the decline of Western Alaska Chinook? For the marine portion of their life cycle, they are mostly resident in the Bering Sea, all linked to common cause of decline. I see Delbert nodding his head there. What are the thoughts here about what's happening with those salmon stocks?
I did read up on this Gnome Nugget on that the die-offs on the Chinooks, and it is really heart-wrenching again for those tribes that subsisted off it can no longer subsist off it on the king salmon itself. I believe it has much to do with the temperature change in the oceans. The food source that they depend on, as well as possibly some health issues that come with diseases or something like that. The if I may, we're talking about what needs to be done. I'm afraid the social media, the world has really become like it's a become a normal, the climate change crisis. There's no more, this should be a wake-up call. They're not calling out the climate change as it is a crisis, the urgent crisis that we are in. And they're not reporting the scientists' warnings of their findings. So to me, it starts with we the people. We the people, the citizens of the world, we the people in Alaska. The Arctic is at its critical point in time to protect the Bering Sea, and not only the sea itself, but the land itself. I'm afraid of this technology that they want to save the earth with, mining for lithium. It's a very industry that got us to where we are today. We, the citizens, it's long overdue, in my opinion. I believe that we need to make a stand on where do we stand on this climate change crisis. And I challenge this in my travels to world leaders, senators, and the citizens. To look at our children and our grandchildren. That we need to make, we have two choices. Either we do the right thing and listen to the scientists and make some hard choices, And the second option is not good. So I'm afraid that the Alaskans need to decide on where we stand and make it political. That's my thinking. To elect leaders that will seriously address the climate change crisis we are in, and we are in urgent, dire need to protect what we have left. And in closing, I'll say about my grandfather's, what he told me in 1983, we're going to witness great changes. And his message and warning to the world, I spoke it in London at the IMO, at the House of the Lords, in Iceland, in Canada, and 4 or 5 trips to Washington, D.C., telling the world my grandfather's message and warning to the world that we must protect what little ecosystems we have left. If we fail, the catastrophic disasters are just going to continue to magnify and quantify to the point of apocalyptic disasters. I'm afraid that we're now witnessing the apocalyptic disasters beginning. So I do believe the Arctic is in urgent need of protection, which has a domino effect to the rest of the world. And the scientists have proven that the Arctic, what happens in the Arctic has worldwide consequences. So,
Absolutely. We know that. Thank you
thank
so
you.
much, Dalbert, for that very, very important context and long lens of seeing these things back to your grandfather's articulate comments about the future. Rick, in the last few minutes here, what are some things that can be done that, as Dalbert said, people need to get behind actions? What are some of the things that you'd like to see happen?
Well, Delbert, as normal, articulated this very eloquently. I mean, he's one of the principal spokespeople for marine ecosystem stability and protection in Alaska, and I really thank him for his long years of doing this, and Matt as well. First of all, the long view, we need to manage climate change. We need to reduce global carbon emissions from 50 billion tons this year down to 10 or 15 billion tons. That's the long challenge. But we need to get very serious about that. And by the end of this century, temperatures can come down, sea ice can begin to reform, and we can recover the marine ecosystems that way. But in the meantime, what's very important is we need to maintain ocean ecosystem resilience. And the way to do that is to reduce overexploitation and reduce pollutant loads. And overexploitation, let me read a quote from the National Research Council in 1996, looking at the Bering Sea ecosystem. They concluded then, this is an independent body of scientists looking at the Bering Sea and what we know about it, 1996, 30 years ago. It is extremely unlikely that the productivity of the Bering Sea ecosystem can sustain current rates of human exploitation, meaning fish removals, as well as large populations of all marine mammals and bird species. Basically, they're saying you can't maximize every component of the marine ecosystem. The only thing we can do there is dial down our exploitation rates. The North Pacific Council is not the right management body. They were, and NOAA has failed as well on this. The council system was established 50 years ago in a very different environment. We didn't understand a lot about climate change in 1976 when these councils were established. They have not been able to adapt the management system. They continue to prioritize fish removals from the system while ignoring marine mammals and seabirds effectively. So my recommendation to the Senate Ocean Caucus has been that they commission a National Academy of Science review of the 50 years of the 200-mile bill and look forward to the next 50 years, what management regime we need to shift to. And that needs to be, instead of a Fishery Conservation Management Act, an Ocean Ecosystem Conservation and Management Act, where all components of the ecosystem, including the non-commercial components like seabirds and marine mammals, are brought into the equation. And we're not doing that now. If we really want to preserve our oceans, to get through this climate bottleneck this century, that's probably the only way to do it.
Thank you for those very succinct ideas. Matt, and we've got a couple of minutes left here. Your thoughts about what you think is needed and what you want to see in the short and longer term.
Yeah, so many times in history, as we're reading history and learning history, we look back and just get so frustrated at these turning points in history. And, oh, why didn't they do that? It's so obvious. We need to do that now. And we need to start thinking about not so much how this is going to impact us, but going into the seven generations concept. How are we going to continue the traditions and the resources that we have now for future generations? And my daughter just turned 9 this summer, and she helps me with all the biological stuff. And last summer, when we saw the couple hundred gray whales, they looked like smokestacks out in the horizon. There were so many. I told her, remember this moment. Because if we, the adults, are not able to do something, it's going to come to you, and it's going to come to the future generations, because we were just sitting on our hands and not opening our eyes and opening our ears and seeing and listening what the oceans are telling us. And just remember, the oceans link all of us, no matter what. And it can be extremely direct for those of us in coastal communities, but it's all the way into interior communities as well throughout the world. And it's time to act now. And I still believe that we have the ability, we just need to have the will to be able to act and come together and remember the cultural traditions, the food security, and definitely advocate for tribal sovereignty and standing together as Alaskans and becoming someone that elsewhere in the world looks to learn from and emulate.
Thank you for that. Going back that to that 50-year marker that you were talking about, the North Pacific Fishery Management Council and the Magnuson-Stevens Act that's kind of kicked all that off, mm-hmm. A very different era when it came to who was being listened to. Were any Indigenous coastal communities involved in any of the formation of that, to your knowledge?
Not at the start. They've made some efforts, the council has, to involve Indigenous perspectives in their management. But basically, the council process is captured by the commercial fishing interest offshore, the factory trawlers and at-sea processors and motherships and things like that. That drives the council conclusions, and it seems to drive the National Marine Fisheries Service and NOAA Fisheries as well. We need to depoliticize management of oceans, make it broader to where we consider the entire ecosystem. We're not doing that now. And there's good people involved all through this on the council, NOAA, and certainly coastal communities. But we need a different paradigm going forward for the oceans. And the time to do that is right now.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being with us today and offering some very clear-eyed assessment of what's happening currently, but also ideas for change for the future. It sounds like we need to talk of Alaska on the 50 years since the formation of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. And I wanted to also let folks know that we will, on the Talk of Alaska post at alaskapublic.org, we will link to the NOAA Alaska Stranding Hotline. So if you're out and about and you see whales, either in trouble or stranded or dead, washed up, please call this number, 877-925-7773. And as I said, we will link to that number so that you can find that there and help the scientists better understand what's happening. Thanks to our guests today, Rick Steiner, Delbert Pungawi, and Matt Van Dale. Thanks to our crew. Our engineer on the board was Crystal Hyde. Our producer is Emily Messner. Our editor is Annie Feit. And on the phones, Ava White helped us out this week. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week. We'll be right back.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.